In the film Burning Season, Wide Angle follows a young Australian entrepreneur named Dorji Sun as he canvasses the globe pitching his idea for a carbon trading company. Dorji hopes to protect the Indonesian rainforests by selling the carbon credits that they represent. In this Wide Angle web exclusive, we'll hear from three different carbon entrepreneurs around the world, each with his own plan for using market forces to protect the environment. But first, we'll talk with David Victor. He's a senior fellow for science and technology at the Council on Foreign Relations, the director of the Program on Energy and Sustainable Development at Stanford, and serves as an advisor to the Obama campaign. The subject of our discussion is carbon trading and other entrepreneurial endeavors aimed at managing carbon emissions. And I was wondering if you could start by just briefly introducing the concept of carbon markets.
Well, the idea behind a carbon market is that governments put a limit on the emissions that are allowed into the atmosphere. And if governments put tight enough limits in place, then over time, less carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases will build up in the atmosphere, and that means less climate change. What happens in a carbon market is that after the government puts a limit, they hand out emission credits to all of the activities that cause emissions into the atmosphere. So those are power plants, refineries, their factories of various types. There's a lot of wrangling about the details of how you're going to hand out these emission credits. It turns out the credits are extremely valuable. In the United States, those credits would be worth several trillion dollars. And so that's a very political process. But once they've handed out these emission credits, then companies are free to buy and sell those credits on the open market the way they buy and sell credits for other pollutants already today and the way most markets function. And the theory is that when companies are free to make that choice in the marketplace, they can decide what is best. Should they invest to control their own emissions, or should they go out to the market and buy credits in order to cover their emissions? And then through the normal operation of the marketplace, the economy finds the cheapest way to meet the overall cap on emissions.
And there are different ways of earning carbon credits. Some examples are tree sequestration, agriculture, and clean development projects. I was wondering if you could talk about the different methods and how they work and how reliable you think they are.
The only countries that are imposing caps on their emissions right now are the advanced industrialized countries, and in particular in Western Europe, where all the European countries together have put a common cap on their emissions and set up one of these emission trading systems, or what's often called a cap and trade system. The European system includes only emissions from industrial sources in Europe. But that would be highly constricting for the Europeans because there are many opportunities not only inside Europe but also around the world to reduce emissions from factories, for example, in China and India, and also to reduce emissions from activities like deforestation that are currently not regulated directly inside the European system. The way they include those other sources of emissions is through various schemes that are called offsets. One of them is the Clean Development Mechanism, and that's a system that's underneath the Kyoto Treaty on Global Warming that allows countries in the industrialized world, such as in Europe, to go around the world and to find the lowest cost ways of controlling emissions in the developing countries and then to get credit for those activities. And in addition to the Clean Development Mechanism, there are a lot of discussions underway right now that would extend those kinds of offsets to include deforestation, other changes in land use, and other kinds of activities.
So Europe has the most developed market system. Can you talk about how that's going? Are they succeeding in lowering greenhouse gas emissions?
The European market, I think, has generally been a positive experience, but it's clearly had some teething troubles. For example, the first 3 years of the market, it became clear that the governments had handed out too many emission credits. And once companies figured that out, not surprisingly, the price of the credits went down to zero because they weren't very scarce. In the second round of the market, which is what's underway right now, emission credits have been much more scarce, prices have been higher, and generally the market has functioned much better. I think one of the most important lessons that we've learned from the European experience is that companies have a very limited number of options available to them for controlling emissions. Over the long term, 10 or 20 or 30 years, they can invest in all kinds of new technologies that have much lower emissions. But these markets don't yet work in the long term. They only work in the short term. The time horizon for Europe is about 5 years. And so any individual company is pretty tightly constrained in what it can do. And so the companies have been scrambling to try and figure out how they're going to comply with these emission limits. And I think that's going to be one of the biggest challenges to the future.
Are there any examples from the past that we can look to on this?
Until the European system for greenhouse gases, the largest market for pollution in the world was in the United States. It's a scheme that was created back in 1990 as the country tried to tighten its rules on acid rain. What it did is it created a market for emissions of sulfur dioxide, which was one of the leading causes of acid rain, and then allocated emission credits to the large coal-fired power plants around the country, and then set up a market so that those plants would trade those emission credits. And the experience with the sulfur trading program, as it's known, has generally been very positive. And it's almost certainly the case that the sulfur trading program has lowered the cost to the United States of meeting its limits on these acid rain-causing gases.
And can you talk about why markets work better than taxation and regulation, if you think that's true?
Well, my view is that the best policy for dealing with global warming wouldn't be a cap-and-trade system. It would be what economists call a carbon tax. Governments would put a price on emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, but it's carbon dioxide is the most important one, and that's why it's called a carbon tax. And then companies would know exactly what it would cost to comply with this requirement. That would make it much easier for companies to plan their investments. In a cap-and-trade system, like the system that exists in Europe, it's harder to plan investments because you don't know what the price of the emission credits is going to be. So that would be the ideal policy. The real world almost never adopts that ideal policy because the companies that are most exposed to the cost of complying with the policy are worried that the taxes they pay are going to go into the government, are going to get squandered. And so they tend to favor cap-and-trade systems because most cap-and-trade systems, when they're set up, give away the emission credits more or less for free to the existing emitters. And so from the perspective of an individual company, looking at these two different options, the cap-and-trade system always looks better because you are given on day one of the system an extremely valuable asset. And that's politically why almost all governments today, when they're focusing on using markets to control global warming gases, are focusing on cap-and-trade systems rather than taxes.
To what extent do you think this issue should be tackled locally versus internationally?
Well, I think here also is an area where the ideal policy operates very differently from politically practical policies. In the ideal world, you'd get every country on the planet together, you'd agree on a common policy that would apply for 50 to 100 years down the road, and then firms would be able to see rules and start to adjust their behavior. That ideal world doesn't exist because you can't get all the governments in the world around the table and get them to agree on a common set of rules because they have different interests. And even if they did agree, one big government could simply decide to walk away from the policy if it became inconvenient, as the United States did in the case of the Kyoto Protocol. So what's happening in the real world is exactly the opposite, which is that strong policies are emerging not from the global level, but they're emerging in particular locales and countries and regions that care most about the climate problem and also have the greatest administrative capacity to implement the rules needed. So we have an emissions trading system that now applies across Europe. We have in the United States no federal policy really to speak of, but we have many individual locales, including the state of California, states in the Northeast, that are adopting their own individual policies, and then eventually those will morph into a kind of federal policy. You have New Zealand has a policy, Australia has a policy, and you have lots of different policies that are only partially connected to each other. And while that is economically much more costly than an optimal global climate change strategy, the optimal global strategy is, in the real world, not really possible.
But the international community is still working towards a successor treaty to Kyoto?
Yeah, they're working on a successor treaty to Kyoto. The deadline for their efforts is the end of 2009 at a meeting in Copenhagen. The agenda for those discussions is extremely long and complex. Most of the issues are going to prove very, very difficult to gain agreement. My own view is that they won't meet the deadline in 2009, but they will come up with some kind of an agreement. But when we look at the details of the agreement, it's not going to be a strict, aggressive, global treaty that addresses all emissions from all countries. It's going to largely reflect what individual countries are willing to do on their own. And that's why I, as a longtime observer of this, have been much more focused on what governments individually are willing to do and in close coordination rather than on these global treaties.
Okay. And you think this time around the United States will be a, a, a part of this?
I think this time around the United States will be a part of it because both the presidential contenders have serious and strict policies on climate change. That said, I think one of the most difficult issues for the United States as it reengages with the rest of the world will be that it needs a strong and credible domestic policy before it can be seen as credible in other countries. And that process will be a very slow one.
And that brings me to my last question, which is about the two presidential candidates in the United States and their views on this.
Well, so for full disclosure, I'm one of the many people who've been advising the Obama campaign. But what I think is pleasantly striking is that both candidates envision big reductions in emissions over the next 40 years. And both of them favor similar kinds of policies, cap and trade systems. Both of them favor reengaging with the rest of the world. I think the really difficult issue won't be the president. The difficult issue will be Congress. That real policy requires putting together a coalition of supporters in Congress. And so far, we've fallen short on that. There are very, very long lags in the energy system. And so strict policies today will not produce rapid, visible changes. What they will do is produce a whole series of new technologies and investment patterns that over 10 to 20 years will start to become evident. And what worries me most is that the United States in particular doesn't have that policy in place. And so we're not starting to see the radical change early in the technology pipeline so that come 2020 and 2030, we actually are starting to deploy new technologies. The tenor of climate science in the last decade or so has been to identify lots of new ways that the climate is more sensitive, changing in more dangerous ways, and there are more nasty surprises lurking in climate change than I think most people expected when they first focused on this one or two decades ago.